The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
Hey, Prestige Heads, Danny here. We've decided to make a change to when we release our episodes. We're going to start releasing bonus episodes on Mondays and interview episodes on Wednesdays. But news episodes, as always, will still be released on Fridays. Thanks for listening and hope you enjoy the news. Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, just a reminder to check out the live streams every week on a Wednesday at 5 p.m. Pacific time, 8 p.m. Eastern time. We're answering questions. I think we're getting better at it, and we're going to soon have guests on it once we get that whole situation sorted. Also, as always, please consider subscribing to the podcast if you haven't yet. We've got a bunch of really good bonus episodes this week in honor of the UFC fight. We've got a great episode with Jasper Cravens about masculinity, the military, and much more. And that's coming up this Sunday. And of course, please join the Discord if you're interested in things like that. All right, Derek, let's jump in. And of course, by far the biggest news of the week is this memorandum of understanding between the United States and Iran. So there's, you know, first it was signed. Do you want to go briefly over the drama of the docu-signing of this document?
Yeah, so like they signed it, docu-signed it, I think, on Monday or like overnight, you know, depending on time zones, Sunday into Monday. Like the agreement was reached on Sunday. By Monday, people in the Trump administration were telling reporters that it had been signed. It had been signed by Donald Trump, by J.D. Vance for some reason, and by Mohammad Bakir Ghalibaf, who's the speaker of the Iranian parliament and has emerged as sort of the main principal negotiator, I guess, along with J.D., although I don't know what negotiating J.D. has really done here. That was supposed to be an interim thing to just sort of lock the MOU in place until a formal signing ceremony, which was supposed to take place in Switzerland on Friday. J.D. Vance, again, was going to be there with Ghalibaf leading the delegations. They were going to be the ones to put pen to paper. At some point, everybody decided, and this became apparent on Wednesday, that in fact, that they weren't going to do that. They were going to do another long distance signing. So they didn't do another e-signing, which I thought was initially how it had been reported, that they were going to do another electronic signing. But they actually did a pen-to-paper signing between Donald Trump and Masoud Pezeshkian, the president of Iran. Pezeshkian obviously was in Iran. Trump was at Versailles, which is just so funny on so many levels. But he was in France for the G7, and they were having a big fancy dinner at Versailles when he signed his name on the document. And then I guess they faxed it to Iran. Or
do we know if it was in the Hall of Mirrors or no? Because the Hall of Mirrors is where the Treaty of Versailles was signed. It's like this.
Yeah, I don't know.
If you've been to Versailles, okay.
I don't know what room it was in.
It might have been, because that's like a long
like the banquet table.
Room.
Yeah, I mean, if that's where they had the dinner, yeah. I just don't know.
That'd be wild.
he must have signed it and then faxed it, I guess, or somehow transmitted it to the Iranians for Pezeshkian to sign, because there's a picture of Pezeshkian holding up the signature page with his signature, obviously, and pen, and Trump's, you know, looking like it had been, you know, faxed to them or something. I don't, you know, it is sent an email or something, scanned and sent. But who knows? Anyway, that's done. So the thing is signed now, and they're not going to have the signing ceremony on Friday in Switzerland. They are still now, according to AFP, they are still going to have a meeting in Switzerland. At least this is the Swiss foreign ministry saying this. They are still going to have a meeting in Switzerland to discuss, you know, first steps in terms of implementing the MOU. There are details. It's a framework. It's you know, somewhat vague in many points. There are sequencing issues that need to be worked out, and that's what this whole signing ceremony was partly going to be about. It was going to be about getting U.S. and Iranian negotiators in a room talking face to face about some of these issues. They're apparently still going to do that. I don't know if Vance is going to go. I don't know if Ghalibaf is going to go at this point because they're not signing anything. They may just send like lower level teams to discuss some technical issues. I don't even know if the Trump administration has anybody who's capable of discussing technical details of an international document like this. But anyway, there's still a lot that's up in the air about that. This was not off to a great start. If you're looking for like competence in how these things are being done, the Trump administration didn't seem to really know how it wanted to approach even just getting signatures on a piece of paper to get this done. They moved up the signing ostensibly to start opening the Strait of Hormuz and getting the ships flowing and lifting the blockade 2 days earlier than, you know, would have been after the Friday ceremony. I don't know why that required such urgency. They also felt then that they were able to release the text of the MOU, which I guess, they were taking a lot of criticism over these partial or early drafts of the MOU that were being released by media outlets. Bloomberg had one that was clearly like very old when they released it, like several drafts ago. CNN released one that seems to have been an earlier draft, and they were getting a lot of criticism. So I guess they wanted to release the full MOU, but the terms of the full MOU are no more favorable to the United States than the draft ones were. So I don't think they're going to alleviate any criticism there. But that was the other aim, I guess, along with moving up the opening of the strait, was that they were going to be able to put the text out there in its final form.
Well, now that we did that beautiful preamble, Derek, let's get a little bit into the details of what's in it. The big things before we go into details, of course, the sanctions, the Strait of Hormuz, the reconstruction of Iran, the sovereignty of Iran, and of course, the nuclear and related missile issues. So Derek, why don't we start with sanctions and maybe just give a little bit of context about like what the U.S. has been doing to Iran in terms of sanctions for a while?
I mean, Iran, if at this point, aside from North Korea, is probably the most heavily sanctioned country in the world, or at least the longest. There are U.S. sanctions and U.N. sanctions covering, you know, virtually any economic activity in Iran. I mean, they hit the banking sector. That pretty much shuts down or, you know, attacks any sort of economic activity. And, you know, the sanctions that the U.S. imposes, as they do in North Korea, as they do in Venezuela and elsewhere, Russia, are secondary sanctions, which means not only is the U.S. not going to do business with Iran or U.S. companies or U.S. individuals, but nobody's allowed to do business with Iran unless they run afoul of the U.S. government and, you know, maybe can't access dollars or can't access the global financial network because it all funnels through the United States. So, I mean, you know, huge penalties to anybody who wants to do business with Iran, which effectively, cuts off many avenues of economic activity for the Iranians. These are under the MOU, they are supposed to be lifted. It's to be determined when they will finally be lifted. And there's a lot of things that have to go on in terms of negotiating on nuclear issues and you know, related things before potentially you could see the Trump administration or the U.S. government, if it's not the Trump administration, go to like the UN and you know, propose lifting sanctions against Iran, or go to Congress and propose lifting U.S. sanctions, because a lot of them are, you know, backed by congressional. Like, they would require an act of Congress to fully remove. But in the meantime, what's called for in the first 60-day window, which is supposed to be when the U.S. and Iran will negotiate a grand agreement covering all of their grievances since 1979. It's not going to happen, but that's the idea. That in that 60-day window, the U.S. will lift, waive basically all sanctions related to Iranian oil sales. And this is an interesting bit of this, because it's not limited just to sanctions on oil exports. It's anything that the U.S. has sanctioned over that period of time that would complicate or block Iranian oil exports or oil sales. So banking sanctions, insurance sanctions, shipping companies, you know, shipping specific tankers or the companies that manage them, all of those sanctions will need to be waived. Whatever is required to enable Iran to sell oil on the open market is supposed to be waived under this agreement, which is a huge thing. And one of the complaints about U.S. sanctions in general, when they you know, impose these things, is that you can negotiate. They'll sometimes negotiate like a temporary waiver for a particular economic sector, but they never go deeper than you know, like you can sell. I don't know, you can buy medicine, let's say. Like, you know, they're big on saying, you know, the U.S. doesn't sanction humanitarian goods, but they do sanction all the underpinnings of the economy that allow a country to buy and import, let's say, medicine or food or any of those things. So it winds up breaking down. This is different. This is like full lifting of anything the Iranians need to sell oil. So that's a pretty big deal. Longer term, as I said, there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of follow-on negotiations in theory. And the same thing applies, by the way, to you know, similar but somewhat different issue, which is all the billions of dollars in frozen Iranian assets that are stashed, you know, around the world, inaccessible to Iran because of U.S. sanctions or U.S. restrictions. That money is supposed to be freed up. Some of it, I think, is supposed to be freed up fairly quickly. But again, the conditions under which the full package or you know, under which we may do step by step unfreezing those assets are still, I think, vague in the MOU.
Well, this is, I think, really epochal in its shift and what it's going to allow Iran to do. Iran, I think, is going to be able to fully enter the global capitalist economy once these sanctions that have been, I mean, like, Derek, because of these sanctions, maybe we should underline, like, medical drugs and things like that, right? And yes. So this is just like, you know, really collective punishment type thing that no U.S. president has lifted. So, right. You know. Really it's, important.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty about, you know, how quickly companies would be willing to go get in and do business with Iran. I think that's doubly true, given that there's this 60-day window. And Trump has said, you know, he doesn't regard this as like a firm deadline. So if, you know, there's no deal, no grand bargain within 60 days, that doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a return to sanctions or return to conflict, but it leaves the possibility open. So there's a great deal of uncertainty for any company that might be considering, you know, kind of doing business with Iran or setting up shop to, you know, have to worry, like, in 2 months, am I going to be, you know, back on the business end of U.S. sanctions? So I think that's going to chill to some degree the level of economic activity, at least in the short term, that comes out of this.
Absolutely,
but certainly the oil sales will happen quickly. You know, countries have already been buying Iranian oil. I mean, they were selling it through the war. Like, the Washington Post did a piece about this. They were making more money on oil sales during the war than they were before. So I mean, that's going to continue, but there's still a lot that needs to be worked through. And I likewise, you know, when we get into like longer term projections, you know, Iran's economy is a resistance economy. It's been built around the idea of isolation and resistance for, you know, decades at this point, certainly, you know, since the Obama administration first imposed the serious nuclear sanctions in his first term. But even before that, so engaging even with the outside world is going to take some time. Not that the Iranians can't do that or that it won't happen. But I think it will take some time, and it'll be interesting to see how, you know, how that process proceeds. If it gets to that point, again, we don't know if it's going to get to that point because we don't know if there's going to be a grand deal at the end of this.
Well, let's talk about the reason that Trump is lifting these sanctions, which is, of course, the Strait of Hormuz. So what's going on with the Strait of Hormuz?
Yeah, so Hormuz, again, the 60-day period is relevant here because Hormuz is supposed to reopen fully to ship traffic for that 60-day period. During that time, the MOU envisions a dialogue between Iran and Oman, the two countries that sit on either side of the strait, to determine how they will administer. This is another big, potentially huge concession to the Iranians, to determine the administration of the Strait of Hormuz. This is a situation that could wind up unlike any other, you know, similar kind of bottleneck waterway in the world. There, I mean, the MOU says that anything that comes out of this, anything they decide to do, must be in line with the applicable international law, but also with the sovereign rights of the two coastal states, which again is Iran and Oman. So, I mean, they can't just decide to impose tolls, but, you know, people have talked about the idea of fees for services. You know, that's the kind of thing that could be established. Probably would not be a huge revenue generator for Iran or Oman in the way that like tolls would be if that was, you know, if that was something that you could really do under international law, just strictly tolling ships. So, you know, we don't know what that'll look like, but it sort of puts on paper something that the Iranians have been asserting for the last, you know, couple of months, which is they and Oman control the Strait of Hormuz, and that should be recognized. This kind of does recognize that, which again is another big concession.
Yeah, a gigantic concession. And speaking of gigantic concessions, let's talk about this reconstruction fund. So it might be worth going into the details a little bit here about what this appears to be, which is the United States giving money to a country it destroyed, which doesn't usually happen in this way, at least.
No, it's not that. It's not the U.S. just giving money to Iran. And in fact, like this could go very, very wrong if it turns out to just be a slush fund for friends of Trump. But there is the text of the MAO is the United States undertakes with regional partners to develop a definitive mutually agreed plan with at least $300 billion for the reconstruction and economic development of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The mechanism for the implementation of this plan, again, will be finalized as part of this final deal that's supposed to happen in the 60-day window that the MOU opens. I don't think they're going to reach a deal in 60 days, but that's neither here nor there. It's supposed to be a private fund, so private donors, probably managed or administered somehow by the Gulf Arab states. You know, that's left to be determined. You know, as you can see, it's pretty vague on the details of what this is going to look like. It's not supposed to be U.S. government funding going to Iran. And the Trump administration has been very strident in pushing back against that claim over the last, you know, couple of days. Again, it could be something that really does a lot of, you know, provides a great deal of economic benefit or at least reconstruction benefit for Iran. It could also be a huge opportunity for people to just stick their hands in the pot and you know, enrich themselves. So I think it's it very much needs to be a wait and see approach to this to see what it actually is going to do.
I don't think there'll be that much corruption under Trump, Derek. You need to believe more.
Yeah, you know, what do I know? These guys are on the up and up.
Let's talk about Iran's sovereignty.
This one is, the United States of America and the Islamic Republic of Iran undertake to respect each other's sovereignty and territorial integrity and to refrain from interfering in each other's internal affairs. Pretty big detail here. And of course, it's written to go in both directions, but only one of those two countries was actually disrespecting the other's sovereignty and territorial integrity and interfering in its internal affairs. So, the U.S., at least on paper, will have to stop mucking around in Iran's business. What that looks like, again, you know, these things are stated as vaguely as possible. Does that look like a military reduction in the Middle East? Does it look like, is that a promise not to go back to war, as Trump has even said in like the last 24 hours? Like, if I don't like how this is going, I don't like the way it's proceeding, or I wake up and decide I don't like the MOU, I'll just start bombing Iran again. Well, I mean, you know, you've kind of agreed not to do that, it would seem. We'll see. There is a later bit under the naval blockade where the U.S. is, you know, beginning the removal of its naval blockade. It also undertakes to remove its forces from the proximity of the Islamic Republic of Iran. What does that mean? What is proximity? Which forces are we talking about? Surely they're not in the next, you know, 30 to 60 days just going to quit the Middle East entirely. So, it's somewhat up in the air, I think.
Up in the air, kind of an okay movie. Haven't seen it in a long time. That's what I'm contributing to this conversation. Derek, let's talk about the big issue, which of course
vital.
Is vital. Yeah. This is why people listen. Let's talk about the nuclear issue and the related missile issue. And it might be worth talking a little bit about the JCPOA, aka the Obama nuclear deal, and how this MOU relates to that.
So, missiles we can knock out right away. I don't think there's anything in here about Iran's missile program, which is incredible, because that was one of the stated reasons that they went to war with Iran. And if you listen to any of Donald Trump's hilarious on some level comments in France on Wednesday, when he's being asked about the terms of the deal, and basically said, well, you have to let Iran have some missiles. Like, you can't take them all away, because other countries have missiles, and it wouldn't be fair to the Iranians not to have missiles. Like, you just went to war over this. You just literally, like 10 weeks ago, it hasn't even been 3 months. I guess it's been 3 months. Well, no, it hasn't. You just went to war about this, and now, you know, we're talking about, you know, he did the same thing with uranium enrichment, which is another piece of the nuclear thing. So basically, most of the details on the nuclear issues are left for these follow-on negotiations. There is a basic understanding that Iran will do away with its stockpile of highly enriched uranium. How that's going to happen, left for further discussion. It does say that the minimum standard here is that the International Atomic Energy Agency would put a team in Iran and would downblend the highly enriched uranium, which is just basically adding more natural uranium, or you know, taking the proportion of fissile material down to a low level, you know, for reactor use, or you know, at least, you know, further away from weapons grade. Iran has committed to some method of doing away with its highly enriched uranium. You recall that the U.S. wanted the Iranians to send that stockpile to the U.S., which the Iranians were pushing back against. They didn't want to do that. That no longer seems to be the demand. They agreed to discuss the issue of enrichment and other matters related to the Islamic Republic of Iran's nuclear needs. All of this language is, again, very, very much conceding to the Iranians, it seems like, though, again, the details have to be fleshed out in follow-on negotiations. It is similar. I don't think you can compare it to the JCPOA, which was a very detailed, supposed to be a final status document on how, you know, Iran's nuclear program was going to be run for the next 10 to 15 years and under international supervision. And, you know, the U.S. was going to do this in response, and all the other countries that were party to it. That's even that is a reason to not to compare these things, because this is a bilateral thing, and the JCPOA involved a number of other countries. But it does look like some of the preliminary stuff that the U.S. and Iran agreed to before they entered into negotiations on the JCPOA, and particularly conceding that Iran will enrich uranium to some level under international supervision, under safeguards, under, you know, limitations that are imposed by, you know, whatever agreement is drawn up. But there's nothing in here that says, you know, Iran will give up its uranium enrichment and destroy the facilities, like whatever remains of them. They've been attacked, obviously, by the U.S., but, you know, destroy its infrastructure and just, you know, give up on uranium enrichment altogether. There's nothing in there to suggest anything like that. So in that sense, I do think we're on the JCPOA path in a sense. And I know, you know, it's dicey to make that comparison because it makes Donald Trump mad. But I think it's fair to say, like, we fought two wars just to get back to something that begins to approach the deal that he tore up in 2018 that set this all off.
Good stuff. So, of course, the question is, what happens next?
Yeah. So, as I said, the negotiations are supposed to start in Switzerland on Friday in lieu of what was supposed to be a formal signing ceremony. Some group of people is going to get together and start to discuss actually implementing all of this stuff. The immediate effect is around the Strait of Hormuz and the U.S. naval blockade of Iran. Those things are should be going away even as we speak, since, you know, they've now officially signed the deal. That's fairly straightforward. Again, like, in terms of how quickly shipping companies are going to be willing to just sort of flood the Strait of Hormuz with traffic, that's another question entirely. But just in terms of the logistics, like, Iran will no longer be trying to shoot at ships that come through without permission, and the U.S. will no longer be trying to stop vessels going to and from Iran in violation of, you know, what had been a blockade. Those things should go away pretty quickly. The U.S. redeployment or the drawdown of the blockade is supposed to take, I think, 30 days. Under the MOU. So it's not going to be an immediate disappearance of U.S. naval forces, but it will begin at least at this point. So that's what happens immediately. The rest of it, you know, and this is one of the things that people have commented on, the rest of it really requires follow-on negotiations. Even the stuff that's not necessarily all that complicated, the MOU doesn't really flesh out very much in terms of how you're actually going to do this. Like, it says you're going to lift sanctions. What's that going to look like? Is it just going to be a presidential waiver? Are you going to seek something else? You're going to unfreeze Iranian assets. Well, how much and when and where are they coming from? Like, all of these details still, I think, need to be worked out.
And probably one of the things that will, quote, need to be worked out is Lebanon's place. Sorry, I lived in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Lebanon's place for, that's how they pronounce it, Lebanon's place in the MOU.
Yeah, so this is difficult, again, to suss out. The first paragraph of the 14 points in the MOU reads, the United States of America and the Islamic Republic of Iran and their allies in the current war, by signing this MOU, declare the immediate and permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, including in Lebanon, and undertake from now on not to initiate any war or any military operation against each other, and to refrain from the threat or use of force against each other. Again, like, you know, Trump is already threatening to bomb Iran again, which violates this. Anyway, and ensuring the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Lebanon. The final deal will confirm the permanent termination of the war on all fronts, including in Lebanon, and other provisions of this paragraph. So Lebanon is mentioned three times here, including ensuring the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Lebanon, both of which are not being ensured currently because the Israeli military is occupying a very large chunk of southern Lebanon, you know, all the way beyond the Litani River. So there are a lot of questions here about what this is supposed to mean. The obvious initial takeaway is that there should not be any more fighting in Lebanon, which the Israelis are apparently unable to or unwilling to uphold, because they've continued bombing Lebanon every day this week, and, you know, maybe at a slightly lower tempo. The casualty figures that I've seen coming out of Lebanon have been lower the past few days than they were previously, but we're talking about like 5-6 people instead of 10, 11, 12 people killed every day. It's still happening. the big question is, what does this mean for the occupation? And obviously language about the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Lebanon suggests that the occupation has to end, the occupation of southern Lebanon. But Israeli officials, including Israel Katz, the defense minister, and Benjamin Netanyahu, have been saying all week, we're not going to be party to any, we're not going to listen to any part of this that obliges us to change our posture in Lebanon. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. We're going to keep occupying. We're going to keep bombing. We're going to keep targeting what they say is Hezbollah. So right away, you're off to a difficult start here just on this basis. If the Israelis are unwilling to kind of honor the commitments that this MOU seems to put upon them, and if Donald Trump is unwilling to pressure the Israeli government to do that, what does that mean in terms of the Iranian position? There have been claims, like Hezbollah officials have been saying, that they didn't think the Iranians would sign the MOU back again when there was supposed to be a signing ceremony on Friday. There were Hezbollah officials telling reporters, like, you know, they're not going to sign the deal unless, you know, Israel withdraws and there's an end to the fighting. Abbas Araghchi, the Iranian foreign minister, has suggested that Lebanon is a point of potential breakdown here. I just don't know. I don't know what the Iranians are going to do if they're already being tested, really, because as I say, the Israelis haven't even stopped firing, let alone, you know, broached the idea of a withdrawal, without which I don't think it's tenable to maintain a real ceasefire. So, this is, I think, still the biggest vulnerability here in terms of this whole thing breaking down, is what is the Israelis going to do in Lebanon, and what is the U.S. prepared to do if they don't kind of abide by the MOU's terms, or what the MOU seems to say, again, somewhat vague, about what it would look like, and then what are the Iranians prepared to do if that plays out the way, you know, you expect it to.
Speaking of Israel and Israel-Palestine, of course, Gaza is not in the memorandum of understanding. So what does this suggest, Derek?
Correct. I don't know that it suggests anything except that the Iranians don't regard Hamas or Gaza in the same way that they regard Hezbollah as you know, a core regional partner. And they don't feel the same sense of responsibility. The relationship between Hamas and Iran has been more challenging, I think, than the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran. Not to say that there's, you know, they haven't, you know, had some affinities over the years, or a great deal of affinity over the years, but it hasn't been the same kind of seamless relationship that Iran has with other groups, non-state actors, in the Middle East. So I wouldn't draw too many conclusions here. I mean, the other conclusion you can draw is that the Iranians just figured that was a bridge too far, that they could get maybe a ceasefire in Lebanon. They could get, you know, some change in status in Lebanon, but putting Gaza into it was going to be too much to get a deal done. And I think they did want to get a deal done. So, I mean, you know, that's probably also part of the consideration.
And let's talk about the West Bank. How's it going there, Derek?
Not good. So this is, I think, quietly a pretty significant thing that happened this week. Is Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister in the Israeli government, who also has a post in the defense ministry that gives him authority over activities in the West Bank, announced on Wednesday that he is approving new settlement construction in the city of Hebron in the West Bank, and also asserting control over the Ibrahimi Mosque, which is the site that's holy to Muslims, Jews, and Christians. It's known to Christians and Jews as the Cave of the Patriarchs, or the Tomb of the Patriarchs, where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I think, are supposed to be buried. The Ibrahimi Mosque, you know, Abraham's Mosque, is indicative of that connection. Hebron, since 1997, has been divided about 80% under the control of the Palestinian Authority, about 20% under Israeli control. It's a heavily settled for a West Bank city, is pretty heavily settled by the Israelis. And so then there was this agreement in 1997, the Hebron Agreement, that kind of split the administration. The Ibrahimi Mosque is in the 20% that's under Israeli control. But the document, the Hebron agreement, leaves its administration or left its administration under the authority of the Palestinians. That is now no longer applicable. And apparently, you know, we're just tearing that agreement up, which leaves the space for a lot of potential tension and unrest in Hebron. It's also, and I think this is maybe the bigger thing, there have been stories, speculation, rumors, no hard reporting, but there have been some stories written recently about the possibility that the Israelis will try to take over Al-Aqsa Mosque, not like in an administrative capacity, like, you know, and then who knows from there, but that they will try to take that from the Waqf, the Jordanian Waqf or charitable endowment that runs, administers that site. And this could be a test run for that, like taking over Ibrahimi Mosque in this way could be, you know, something that you do to sort of see how it goes and then move on to something even more sensitive in Al-Aqsa in Jerusalem.
Which would be very more sensitive being an understatement, Derek, but yeah. That's what I appreciate about you. All right, let's leave the Middle East. Let's talk about Sudan, in which preparations for a major battle seem to be coalescing.
Yeah, the Sudan Tribune reported on Monday that the Rapid Support Forces has amassed what it called unprecedented military reinforcements around the city of El Obeid, which is the capital of Sudan's North Kordofan state. The Sudanese military at that time said it was anticipating a major attack on the city within 3 days. We're now 3 days out, and that hasn't happened, at least to my knowledge, yet. But I don't think the RSF is, you know, massing forces around El Obeid, which it's been trying to capture for you know, some time now, just because it felt like, you know, deploying forces there. It's clearly planning something. It's been bombarding El Obeid with drones for, you know, over a week at this point, at least, probably longer than that, on a pretty daily basis, targeting mostly logistical things, fuel depots, munitions, storage facilities, that type of thing. So it seems like they were softening up, or have been softening up the city for an attack. The concern here, and, you know, we won't know until it happens, but the concern here is that if they are able to take the city, it's going to be another essentially genocidal frenzy like we saw in El Fasher in North Darfur state, that, you know, you will see a lot of civilians killed here. So there's a lot of concern around this and just keeping track of it.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Ukraine. First, let's talk about this Russian advance.
This was interesting. The Ukrainian military made a big deal earlier this week about having net gained territory, regained territory last month, which is an unusual thing in the course of this war. The Russians, although their advance has not been fast, obviously, typically, you know, on a month-to-month basis, they are taking more territory than the Ukrainians are, let's say, taking back. But last month, there was a net gain to the Ukrainians of around 100 square kilometers. There were other estimates from other outlets that put the figure higher than that. But at the same time, even as there's this overall, you know, small push by the Ukrainians, the Russians have made significant gains in the city of Konstantinivka, which is one of the four fortress belt cities in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk Oblast. If the Russians seize it, and I think they've seized at this point a pretty good chunk of it. I don't know exactly the percentage, and these things are difficult to try and independently assess anyway. But this is one of the four cities that the Ukrainians are the so-called fortress belt, kind of guarding that last bit of Donetsk that Ukraine controls. And if the Russians are able to take it, that's obviously will be a huge blow to the Ukrainian defensive position.
And what about Crimea?
Crimea has been one of the targets of the Ukrainians. I think we've talked about this previously, but the Ukrainians have really been pounding Crimea logistically. They've been attacking roads and bridges connecting Crimea to southern Russian-occupied southern Ukraine. They've been attacking fuel depots in Crimea. There's been fuel rationing in the peninsula, and now even that is, I think, failing in some cases. And there was a story in Al Jazeera this week about how bad conditions in Crimea have gotten, how isolated the peninsula seems at this point. People are struggling, you know, to get fuel, to get food, just basic, you know, goods, life, or it's been difficult to get things into the peninsula. And I think, you know, I suspect this is an acknowledgement by the Ukrainians on some level of like that they're not getting Crimea back. Like, I know the policy in Kyiv has been, you know, we're going to take back every inch of territory that the Russians have taken. But this is what's being done to Crimea, which is, you know, to intended to affect the Russian military logistically, but it's also intended to demonstrate kind of a fragility of the peninsula's position. Within this conflict, nevertheless, like you do this kind of thing, and it's very difficult to imagine, even in an ideal circumstance, where the Ukrainians suddenly have some major breakthrough and are able to, seize territory, and the Russians just collapse and fall back. Like, how are you going to bring this population back into Ukraine? I don't know, and I think, treating the peninsula in this way suggests that the Ukrainians have sort of given up on that idea, but that's my speculation.
And we will, of course, TBD. Let's talk about the G7 summit, which, as we talked about, was surprisingly uneventful. And let's also relatedly talk about what the G7 is saying about Ukraine.
I think the end of the Iran war, at least the temporary end of the Iran war, like, calmed Trump down on some level. Like, he wasn't, his grievances that the rest of the G7 didn't like race to his rescue when it turned out he didn't know how to win the war he'd started were no longer relevant. So he seemed relatively pleasant, I guess. And there were no major spats or incidents, which is big for him in an international setting like this. They even issued a joint statement at the end. So, it seems to have been a fairly smooth, relatively speaking, fairly smooth event. The statement did focus quite a bit on Ukraine. Everybody agreed to, you know, support Ukraine. And here's another mention of territorial integrity and to intensify sanctions against Russia. The U.S. is already... quietly, as Reuters reported on Wednesday, it allowed the waiver that it issued on Russian oil sanctions to expire. That waiver was issued during the war, during the Iran war, to kind of, you know, juice global oil markets and get more product flowing. That's no longer relevant, of course, but it's not clear whether the U.S. is going to start enforcing these sanctions again or not. They just kind of quietly didn't renew the waiver without saying anything about what their intention is at this point. But in the context of a G7 where everybody agreed to kind of try to tighten the screws on Russia, this may be one way that the U.S. is doing that, taking advantage of the fact that the Iran war is over and the rationale for that waiver no longer exists.
Staying in Europe, let's talk about the United States, which has announced plans for a drawdown on the continent.
Yeah, this was in... The New York Times a few days ago that the U.S. military has reportedly started telling NATO allies of its some specific plans to reduce forces in Europe. That includes cutting the number of F-16s and F-15s in Europe by a third. They currently have around 150 deployed in Europe. They would cut that down to 100. They will redeploy a submarine and an aircraft carrier along with other warships, reducing the number of reconnaissance aircraft that they have dedicated to Europe, redeploying one of the two groups of bombers that they have assigned for European defense. So these are significant cuts, and, you know, they are... The upshot of this is that European governments were aware that the administration was going to do this, but it's happening on a timetable that they were not expecting. So it's happening earlier, or the plan is for it to happen earlier than they were prepared for it to happen. So, you know, they will have to adjust to that, I guess. And you know, as we've seen, Europe's efforts to kind of stand up and defend itself are not going so great. So, you know, we'll see how that goes.
Thanks, Derek. Let's take a quick detour to South America and talk about Peru, where Fujimori, or the daughter of the original Fujimori, has taken lead in the vote count.
Yes, Keiko Fujimori appears to have, it's funny to say this, but she appears to have, I think, an insurmountable lead at this point in Peru's presidential runoff. And I say it's funny, the reason I say it's funny to say that is because she has about 5% of the vote, maybe a little bit more at this point. That was the last count that I saw. But what's happened basically is she was just slightly behind Roberto Sanchez when the tabulated votes were counted. Then they got into the expat vote, and that heavily favored Fujimori. She eked out a very small lead, and then they got into the contested ballots. And the contested ballots have also broken her direction. This was predicted. I think we said last week many of those ballots were from the Lima area, where Fujimori did quite well. And so, you know, that has only extended her lead. And, you know, again, it's like a point, maybe, or a tenth of a point lead. But I don't see a way that Sanchez can is going to get like a block of votes that will shift this. So I think Fujimori, after trying, you know, four or five times to be president, she is now finally, I guess, going to be president of Peru. But we'll see how it plays out.
Derek, as I'm always telling you, you got to believe in yourself. You got to persevere. Well, Derek, in a typical American Prestige style, we are closing with something quite grim. I would like to point people to the interview we did with Caitlin Tulloch a few weeks ago on USAID. But Derek, why don't you quickly tell us the UNAIDS report, which has shown the effect of the DOGE cuts.
Yeah, the latest UNAIDS global brief, which was published late last week, does not paint a great picture. On the one hand, it still cites a great deal of progress that's been made in the global effort to combat HIV/AIDS. New infections, new HIV infections, are continuing to decline. AIDS-related deaths are declining. They hit the lowest level in more than 30 years in 2025, according to this report. But the grim stuff is sort of, you know, in projections for what this situation could look like in a few years, thanks in large part to the DOGE cuts, but also to other Western countries kind of taking their lead from the Trump administration, and also slashing their humanitarian aid budgets. So the top line from that perspective is that the number of people who received PrEP medication, pre-exposure prophylaxis, declined by 38% from 2024 to 2025. So that means more people are at risk. More than a million fewer people were receiving PrEP medication last year than we're receiving it in 2024. The funding for condoms has also been cut. It says in some cases by more than 90% in this report. So prevention is even as there's still been progress in terms of the outcomes, the level of prevention is declining steeply because of a lack of funding, and that suggests that, you know, down the road you're going to see a reversal of some of these gains that have been made.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please like and review us on Apple. That has slowed down, which actually does affect us. So if you wouldn't mind taking a moment just to do that, we would really appreciate it. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.